Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, how Amazon has joined fellow tech giant Google in commissioning its own nuclear reactors to power its new-look data centres. Why debt-riven Ethiopia has decided to launch its very first IPO. And free subscriptions that turn out not to be free. The US regulator tells us why it's bringing in new rules to fix them.
A simple mechanism to cancel. And that has to be as easy to use as it is to sign up.
More on that later in the show. First, though, to a story that's been dominating the global headlines for the last 3 weeks or more. Dramatic attacks, bombardments of Hezbollah targets by Israel in southern Lebanon and indeed in the north of the country. Israel is ramping up its campaign against the militant group, with troops now in parts of the south. Thousands of civilians have died. We're hearing more than 1 million displaced. That's perhaps a quarter of the country's entire population by some estimates. Among those now homeless, tens of thousands of foreign workers as well. They're mostly women from Southeast Asia and Africa. For this programme, we've collected testimony from a few of these especially vulnerable individuals. They've been employed usually as domestic workers, and they found themselves thrown out by their employers because of the dire security situation. People like Mina from Uganda.
The girl threw me out of the door. She closed the door. I'm helpless, nothing at all. It was bombing, of course. So I was shaking, I'm helpless. If you ask anybody for help, no one is helping because the houses are burning, people are crying. So I was like, what is this? What's going on? I'm dying like this.
The experience there of one Ugandan domestic worker while enjoying very few employment rights. The situation for women like this in Lebanon was already difficult before the war started. The average monthly salary for African domestic workers is estimated to be around $250 a month. 24-year-old Kenyan Andaku says she was left with nothing when the bombardment started in the village where she worked.
When the bombing was too much, they ran for their lives and they left me in the house. They locked me and they went. So I had nowhere to go. When they came back, they threw me out. They never paid me and I had nowhere to go. I took a bus to Beirut, so I had to take my way.
Well, in some ways, these women are lucky. They've found shelter with local charities, but resources and safe spaces are scarce now. In audio recordings sent to the BBC, dozens have said that they remain stranded on the streets of Beirut. They're in desperate need of food. Many say they've been denied shelter because the authorities were prioritising Lebanese families in need, and in most cases, these workers don't even have travel documents. The two Sierra Leonean women who spoke to Reuters news agency a few days ago, they said their passports had been confiscated by their employers.
No, I don't have them with me. I leave them in my employer's house. They hold our documents since the day we came in Lebanon.
I only have a copy. With my madam, the way she was treating me is not good. Sometimes no food. They are bullying us, shouting at us.
Too much work for me. I don't have time to rest. Sometimes I work from morning till night. I don't know yet what will happen in the future. I feel scared because of the war. Yeah, I'm scared of Lebanon.
Well, UN officials say that most of Lebanon's nearly 900 shelters are now full, and they're voicing concerns for the tens of thousands of foreign migrant workers who've been abandoned in this way. I've been speaking about their plight with one of the grassroots aid groups that's helping them. Farah Salka runs Lebanon's anti-racism movement in Beirut, which works with migrant communities.
Many of these women are discriminated against and at high risk of exploitation, abuse, you name it, while being homeless on the street in a place that is anyway not familiar to them.
Right. So where are the most of these 400,000 female migrant workers from?
Yeah. So many of these women come from countries in South Asia or Southeast Asia, from sub-Saharan Africa. So they are stuck in limbo, basically. There's at least 30 different nationalities that are presented at the Migrant Community Center, which the anti-racism movement runs.
Yeah. How many people do you have in your center?
So there are more than 1,000 members registered at the center, but due to the situation right now, we have lost touch with a lot of these people who have been long-term members of our space. We can't reach them. They can't reach us. Movement is very difficult. It's very dangerous. Some people have lost their phones. So it's a really, really horrid picture here.
Yeah. I mean, they are generally employed, aren't they, or frequently employed under this kafala system. Just explain to us very briefly what that system of employment is and how that works for these women.
The kafala system, which is also known as the sponsorship system in English, is a labor system that is applied in Lebanon and many countries in the Gulf, which gives individual citizens and companies almost total control over a migrant worker's employment and immigration status and basically her life here.
They can't get work for anybody else, right? Once they've come, they can only get stick with the one employer, and frequently their passports are taken away from them on arrival. Is there any way of getting them passports and paperwork? Is there any effort by, let's say, the host countries, the countries they're from, to repatriate these people?
Well, that's a very good question, because in a matter of weeks, there might be tens of thousands of migrant workers who need to leave Lebanon. The embassies and governments of these migrant workers need to be serious enough to scale up and put in the efforts and resources needed for this massive operation of repatriating thousands or tens of thousands of people in a matter of weeks. In addition to that, the Lebanese government needs to commit to fast-tracking their processes and legal proceedings to get them their exit clearances, give them laissez-passer in the absence of passports if they've lost their passports. So there's a lot that needs to happen for us to be able to see all these women go back to their homes and their countries.
Do you sense that there's any political will to make that happen?
I mean, right now everybody in Lebanon is on extreme survival mode. You need to have people who are actually able to go to work, and you need to have buildings that are actually still standing for you to be able to process thousands and tens of thousands of files and names and all of this. So there's a lot at play. There's an overall beautiful community sense all over the country. That's the only thing we have right now, really. People are trying to do their best to support each other. They're cooking for each other, they're sheltering each other, they're driving around very dangerous areas to pick each other up, even if they don't know each other. Just by mere fact that one person ends up hosting a family of five, they end up hosting 10 families. People are doing what they can with the little energy they have. They're picking up the pieces of all the gaps and all the vacuum that is there because of the complete lack of international support, solidarity, action that we had hoped we would get to stop us from getting to where we are right now.
That's Farah Salka of Lebanon's anti-racism movement on the plight of tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of migrant workers trapped in the country. Amazon has announced it is joining what looks like a wider push by US tech firms right now towards nuclear power as a source for its data centers. The company says it signed 3 agreements on developing small modular nuclear reactor technology. This follows similar announcements from Google earlier in the week, because these data centers are indeed very power hungry. I've been speaking about this with John Dicklev. He's the founder of Flower, a Stockholm-based firm which provides companies with energy solutions.
So as we sort of build out our generative AI capabilities, these data centers that will build the foundational models behind them will require huge amounts of energy to develop the algorithms. And in doing so, we will sort of put a new requirement on top of the already existing energy transition to facilitate the growth of AI.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen estimates saying could be 10, 15, I mean, huge percentages of global consumption in the future could now be, you know, put into this processing, this data processing consumption.
Yeah, exactly. That's great. It sort of adds to the challenge of already moving the fossil-based energy consumption to electricity-based, just putting more on top of that, further underlying the need to rapidly build out our power production and distribution capabilities.
So Amazon has said it signed 3 agreements to support the development of nuclear energy projects. These are these kind of modular advanced nuclear reactors. They're very small things. They can move them around. SMRs, they're called small modular reactors, and they can put them closer to the grid where they have their data centers. Is that right?
Yeah, they're probably not that small that you can easily move them around with your car or anything like that. They're still huge power production facilities. They're typically just smaller than what we've built historically. But you're right in sort of putting them close to the point of consumption might allow that consumption point to get access to power more quickly.
Why is nuclear suddenly seen as such a good solution for these big tech companies?
I think they see it as a way to round the queues of connecting to the grid. And that's why they want to invest in finding solutions to more rapidly be allowed to access power.
Because what? It's carbon neutral, but it's also producing massive power on demand.
Yeah, I think primarily it's a way to secure up power generation close to your data center facilities without necessarily having to rely on the entire power system and the power grid. And then, yes, it's also not a sort of fossil-based fuel, which I think is a sort of criteria for these players on a employee branding and overall branding perspective.
Yeah, they want to seem green and clean, don't they? Tell me then,
yeah.
Is it realistic? I mean, I've seen estimates that, Google's going to be carbon neutral and getting these modular reactors up and running by 2030. I'm not sure what the estimates are for Amazon. 2040, I think, is theirs. Can they turn this around that quickly? I mean, this technology hasn't really been deployed by national grids very much in the rich world. And yet now we've got these tech companies doing it.
The timelines are generally optimistic when it comes to new projects. Without saying too much about these specific suppliers, I think they're hoping to find a solution. I think that's also the reason why they're calling it pilot projects, is because they don't know if this is the path they'll actually go. So it's something they're trying.
What would you recommend?
Well, we see a path forward with rapidly falling costs in solar and also energy storage. And you couple that with the production profiles of wind. And then sometimes you might need some sort of peaker plant that would provide you a sort of similar solution with proven technologies.
But Google and Amazon see it differently.
Yeah, I think you always need to respect the project-specific requirements. But there is a way, in our point of view, to sort of supply energy in a stable and reliable way from wind and solar, if you add the necessary sort of backup capacity with, for example, batteries.
Do you think the infrastructure is there? Because I think a lot of these companies are getting a lot of heat and certainly more attention for not necessarily having the infrastructure ready to go with these very energy-hungry projects that they're now driving forward at pace.
Yeah, and that might add to why they're choosing this other path to go nuclear, because otherwise they're sort of starting to consume a huge chunk of public utilities. This might be a way of sort of isolating away from that and saying, okay, we're building our own stuff. But if we build a larger and stronger power system, that's also more beneficial to all.
Swedish energy expert John Decleff. Well, listening to that, George Conboy is with us. He's chairman of Brighton Securities in the US. It's interesting, this move by Amazon, isn't it, George? The way that nuclear has become so fashionable, it seemed almost like a dead technology to many not so long ago.
Right. Well, in Rochester, New York, we had a very small nuclear reactor privately owned by a private company, the once esteemed Eastman Kodak.
I think we may have lost George. Sadly, we're going to move on. Hopefully, George will be summoned from the ether, the technological ether, later in the show. George, are you with us? Can you hear us still?
I am. Sorry, there may have been a glitch there.
Yeah. Okay. So, listen, let's just move on to the this other big story we're seeing today. The European space giant Airbus has announced it's laying off up to 2,500 workers from its defence and space division. Now, it's news. I guess it follows very similar announcements from Boeing earlier in the week. What is going on with the plane makers?
It is. Well, you've had this duopoly for years, and investors often believe that they could do no wrong, neither of them. And a few years ago, we had Boeing stumble in a major way, and it looked like Airbus is also not immune to those kinds of problems. You go so long without real competition, and Boeing stubbing its toe sort of left Airbus in a position of being able to do no wrong. We're finding that both those organizations are fallible, and they're going to be subject to economic constraints like any other firm.
Interesting. And I guess the slowdown in China is affecting them, because they were buying a lot of the planes, weren't they?
Yeah, big piece of that. China influences everything.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, Ethiopia is seeking to raise some $250 million by selling shares in its state-run wireless company. It will be the nation's first initial public offering, and it's paving the way to start a stock exchange in the country. 100 million shares in Ethio Telecom are to go on sale in a move that's meant to ease the rules of doing business in this indebted East African nation. I've been speaking about all of this with Yosef Getacho. He's CEO of Rise Addis, an investment advisory firm based in Addis Ababa.
The company is Ethio Telecom. It's a company that has been in the business for over 130 years. It's one of the biggest state-owned enterprises in the country, and now the public would have an opportunity to buy shares from this company.
Are there buyers to buy $250 million worth of shares, do you think?
If you ask me frankly, I think the retail market, the retail investor would buy. There is a huge liquidity trap in the economy. So institutional investors might not commit much of the capital, but I would expect the public to chip in and buy the shares. The offer is also for Ethiopians only. So you have to show and verify that you are an Ethiopian citizen to participate.
Why is it only open to Ethiopians?
One thing I suspect is this has been in the story for over 3 years. And if you look at our country at the moment, there are not a lot of positive news is coming out. We still are on ongoing civil war in at least two of our biggest regions. And I think government, in a way, is trying to give something positive to talk about.
So it's a feel-good event. It's an event that could lead, we're hearing, perhaps to the launch of a more formal stock exchange situation so that people can buy and trade shares more widely in Ethiopia.
Yes. I mean, the Ethiopia Securities Exchange, as per the latest information we received from the CEO, they are currently in the process of procuring a system, the technology to support the trading, and the expectation from the government has been launching it towards the end of the year, which we are now. So maybe if things go according to plan, December, November, if not, Q1 2025 would have a securities exchange where the public can actually trade.
Do you think that that's a recipe for a sustainable growth in the finance sector there? Because I think the fear will be that while Ethiopia remains such a protected economy, to some extent quite a closed economy to foreign investors, it won't feel like this is a stock exchange that is equivalent to others that we can see on the African continent.
To build that vibrant capital market ecosystem, yes, liberalization is happening on the other side, but you need to create a stable political situation in country. You need to avoid civil wars that are ongoing within different regions in the country. It's going to be a long road. It's not going to happen overnight.
The thoughts there of Joseph Getacho, an investment advisor in Ethiopia. George Comboy is still with us. You speak a bit of in Amharic, I understand.
Yeah, I've got to remember that. Hulet is two, if I remember correctly.
Right, okay. You don't know what Amharic and for initial public offering is.
I can deal in Ethiopian Bur, but it's been a long time.
Okay, all right. I'll pause the questions there then. Let's just switch back to Wall Street, where banks, I understand, have been enjoying bumper fees, right? I mean, it's a curious time on the markets.
Oh, yeah.
There are some shares really struggling. We've heard about aviation, but Wall Street banks are enjoying bumper fees right now.
Wall Street banks have a way of managing to enjoy bumper fees whenever they can possibly get their hands on them. Hey, look, U.S. markets are up double digits across the board this year. It's a really good year despite a few dips we've had. Capital is still relatively cheap. And I'll paraphrase Winston Churchill. People ask me, why is the U.S. market doing so well when things look so difficult? And I guess I'd say the U.S. economy is the worst economy in the entire world, except for all of the others. There's my paraphrase with apologies at Churchill.
Yeah. Not great entirely for some of those tech stocks, though. I mean, they're very volatile all over the place. What's been happening today?
No, we look at serious investors who've made very serious profits in the tech sector, and some of those profits are pulling back. Many institutional investors are looking at the opportunity to reallocate some of that tech money and some of those large profits into small and mid-cap companies where profits can still be had. We've got a market that looks not fully priced, but nearly so in that tech sector, and we'll see some sector rotation here, classic sector rotation. Some assets out of tech and into small and mid caps. That's where we're headed.
You heard it here. George Comboy of Brighton Securities. Thank you very much indeed. Now, you may have had that frustrating experience, I know I have, of signing up to some free service or other on the internet, only to find a few weeks later that you've been charged for it when you didn't think you'd signed up for that. US regulators have just announced new rules requiring American businesses to make it as easy as possible to cancel subscriptions and memberships. The so-called click-to-cancel rule requires retailers, gyms, and other businesses to get consumers' explicit consent for subscriptions, auto-renewals, and free trials that convert into paid memberships. I've been speaking about this with James Calm. He's the director of enforcement, the Enforcement Division of the Federal Trade Commission. It has brought into these new measures. Was he spelling out clearly, I wondered, how companies should implement these rules?
We are not, partly because we're covering almost the entire economy over every kind of media. So we have given more direction. So if you're promoting a product in interactive media, like the internet, it has to be easy to find the cancellation, and you can't force people to interact with a live or virtual representative.
Yeah, I particularly like that. So a chatbot, for instance, unless you've consented to it when you initiate the subscription, you can't be made to talk to a chatbot.
Even if you did consent to it in the beginning, you can't be made to talk to a chat box to cancel.
Right. How are you going to punish those who don't comply?
So the rule in the United States comes with civil penalties. So if you violate a rule, we can get redress for consumers. In other words, we can put consumers back in the position they would have been had the violation not occurred. And on top of that, we can get penalties that are meant to punish and deter people in the future.
The Federal Trade Commission has voted 3-2, hasn't it, along party lines to bring in these rules. Republicans on your own committee called this overreach. You know, you lack the authority for such a mandate, they say. It's party political and it's been rushed through to beat the deadline for next month's US election.
Well, that is a dispute among my commissioners, all of whom I represent. But I would say in reading the dissent, there is much that everybody agrees on in this. There is political dispute among the political folks on timing. And there is some dispute on legally whether we can ban misrepresentations beyond the negative option. So we ban misrepresentations about price, cost, features, purpose. And so there's some legal debate about that. But I don't think there's any debate that consumers shouldn't be lied to and that people shouldn't be forced to pay for goods and services they don't want.
I mean, is there evidence that this is happening on a large scale?
There is quite a bit of evidence. That evidence comes in the form of complaints, both to the FTC and others. It comes in the form of comments from consumer groups. It comes in the form of cases from state attorney generals, and it comes in the form of our own cases. We most recently sued Amazon and Adobe in very large cases alleging these very types of violations.
You faced longstanding, over many months, representations from a whole range of businesses, didn't you, saying that these were unnecessary and onerous burdens being placed on firms?
We got just over 16,000 comments.
That sounds like quite a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, it is quite a lot. And those came from enforcers from the states. It came from consumer groups and it came from industry. Much of industry quibbled with pieces of this, but not necessarily the whole. Some quibbled with the entire thing. We think this is a pro-business regulation. So we have no problem with negative option features in a subscription. Those are good for consumers. They allow consumers to try new products. They allow them to use new products for a while and cancel if they don't like them. They allow marketers to get their products out into the marketplace. The problem is, if you're an honest marketer, it's hard to compete. And let me give you an example. You may find this in your own household. I certainly find it in mine, that we don't sign up for a lot of subscriptions, a lot of trials, because we think it's going to be so hard to get out in the end. But if I knew I could get out easily, I might try more things, some of which I might really like and then buy. And marketers are losing all those sales because people don't trust the system.
That's James Calm of the Enforcement Division of the Federal Trade Commission. And that's it for this edition of World Business Report. More from me, Ed Butler, on Business Matters at midnight GMT. For now, though, thanks very much for listening.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.